This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll get an on-the-ground perspective about the new law enacted in Arizona. The law will force police to determine the immigration status of anyone they suspect is an undocumented immigrant. We talk with Sarah Kunstler about the film Disturbing the Universe.
The DVD is out, and it has some extraordinary footage that's not even in this wonderful film. Firsthand from Chicago, you'll hear Bill and the judge go at it. You'll hear Bill from inside Wounded Knee.
Stay with us. We have a few updates to bring you today. On Tuesday, April 27th, Pakistani-born American student Fahad Hashmi took a government plea bargain. He pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy for allowing an acquaintance to store waterproof socks, ponchos, and raincoats in his London apartment. The government dropped the other three charges. Fahad made this decision after having served 3 long years in solitary confinement under special administrative measures, and one day after Judge Preska approved the government's recent request for an anonymous jury with extra security measures. In addition to the use of secret evidence and indefinite solitary confinement in Fahad's case, the move to have an anonymous jury raised already heightened concerns as to whether a fair trial was even possible. With sentencing to happen on June 7th, Fahad faces a maximum of 15 years in prison, as opposed to the 70 years, that's 7 decades, that he might have faced had he been convicted on all 4 counts. With time served already, 4 years total, and with considerations for good behavior, Fahad could be out in less than 10 years. It is noteworthy that on the eve of the trial, the government was willing to shave off 55 years from the potential sentence. This decision in no way detracts from the importance of the work that civil liberties groups have been doing to bring attention to the civil rights issues that Fahad's case raised. The government's use of special administrative measures and the attacks on due process in so-called terrorism cases like Fahad's continue to cast a pall on the U.S. justice system. As listeners will remember from our interview with Fahad's father and later with his brother, the special administrative measures had called for 23-hour-a-day lockdown, constant video surveillance of his cell, and strict limitations on visitation. In the wake of the death of a hunger-striking Cuban inmate in February, the mainstream U.S. media has published a rash of stories condemning the so-called human rights violations leading to the death of Orlando Zapata Tamayoris. Both the U.S. corporate media and foreign governments have been misrepresenting the facts for their own political ends. U.S. criticisms of foreign state abuses of power often ring hollow. This is especially true when the criticisms are directed at a nation that has suffered from a half-century-long economic embargo and unconstitutional travel ban. It also carries little weight coming from a media that pays scant attention to treatment of the ever-expanding U.S. prison population and human rights violations that take place within our own borders. The political motivation behind this media onslaught is clear, however. During the Bush administration, Cuban dissidents were paid by the U.S. government to criticize the Cuban government. Since the overthrow of the U.S.-aligned Comprador dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista, more than $20 million has been funneled to anti-Castro activists and media outlets in both Cuba and within the United States. Now the U.S. media is using a tragic incident to browbeat the communist government of Cuba. The National Lawyers Guild has long opposed this double standard toward the Cuban government and calls on the U.S. media to recognize U.S.-propagated human rights abuses, particularly in Latin America. Since 1946, this government has operated the School of the Americas, now the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, in Fort Benning, Georgia. The 61,000 graduates of the school have been trained in torture techniques and have gone on to overthrow democratically elected governments in several Latin American nations. These coups and the regimes that have followed them involve massive human rights violations with hardly any coverage from the U.S. media. The National Lawyers Guild opposes violations of human rights anywhere, and so urges the U.S. media to turn its attention instead to those countries that are exploiting an unavoidable tragedy while covering up their own inhumane prison systems and deadly foreign policies. Today we get a perspective from the Arizona border on how the state's new immigrant law will impact human rights. Many have expressed outrage at the state law that would force police to determine the immigration status of someone suspected of being an undocumented immigrant. We'll talk with Jennifer Allen, Executive Director of Border Action Network. Border Action Network was formed in 1999, and members work with immigrants and border communities in southern Arizona to ensure that human rights are respected and that human dignity is upheld. Jennifer Allen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for this opportunity to be on the show.
Now, Jennifer, we're here to talk about SB 1070. Can you tell us in a nutshell what's wrong with this bill?
Well, this is one of the most far-reaching, broad-stroke efforts from the state of Arizona to try to take on, through a backdoor approach, the enforcement of federal immigration laws. The component that has made the biggest headlines nationally and internationally is the fact that the law would mandate that local law enforcement essentially use racial profiling as a tool to ask people to prove their immigration status within the state of Arizona. Other components of the legislation include criminalizing day laborers and those that seek to hire them. There's some prohibitions against local cities and towns enacting any kind of policies or ordinances that might, for example, protect victims and witnesses of crimes who are undocumented. They include some other provisions that would require local cities, towns, agencies to save information about people's immigration citizenship status and then share that information with other agencies. But really, the biggest, most far-reaching, horrendous component of the legislation is law enforcement being required, with the threat, actually, of lawsuits being filed against them if they do not ask people about their immigration status based on just their appearance.
Right. Now, let's just explore that a bit further. Law enforcement agents who do not want to enforce this, they're open to lawsuits by private individuals or by the government?
By private individuals. So if a citizen, for example, in the state of Arizona, believes their local police department is perhaps giving too much attention to a DUI checkpoint, and that in so doing that they are not fully complying with the letter of SB 1070 and enforcing immigration, then they could bring charges up against that law enforcement agency, and the agency would face a fine of $1,000 to $5,000 a day every day that they are not fully implementing SB 1070.
So it essentially dictates the priorities of the law enforcement units around the state.
Absolutely. And that is one of the reasons that law enforcement have been opposed to this legislation, as well as local city councils and mayors and county government, because it's mandated. It essentially takes away the local decision-making of local law enforcement in local towns.
It takes away the discretion, which is such a key component in law enforcement. What will you say to people who claim that something needs to be done to protect the borders and to enact a sensible immigration policy?
You know, we agree. Indeed, we do need a sensible immigration policy. And we do need to have borders that are safe, that are secure, that are orderly, that are well managed. This legislation at a state level is simply not that solution. In effect, it will result in a patchwork approach to immigration enforcement, to border controls. We have heard that there are approximately six other states around the country who are now considering similar pieces of legislation. That's why we've been calling on the administration to step in to clamp down on SB 1070, because if it's not stopped in Arizona, it will surely spread throughout the rest of the country.
The focus of SB 1070 in Arizona is clearly the Latino population. Would you see this, if it spreads around the country, having application to other communities of color?
Absolutely. The language, the way that the law is written, is so broad that everybody essentially falls into its net. So it would be anybody, any person of color in particular, that a law enforcement agent might have the reasonable suspicion that the person might not have, you know, their immigration papers in their purse or in their pocket, would be subject to questioning and detention, possible arrest, if they cannot produce their immigration paperwork.
I can't remember, but I'm sure that Arizona shares the problem with the rest of the country of prison overcrowding and really sort of institutionalizing a whole strata of people in this country. How are the prison conditions, and do you envision a lot of individuals being incarcerated as a result of this?
In fact, our state is about, I think, a $13 billion budget deficit. So one of the things that the Arizona Department of Corrections has been doing is transferring out before the terms of the sentences had been concluded, all prisoners who were undocumented immigrants, and just immediately transferring them over to ICE custody as a means to free up some of the beds and the space and to cut costs. One of the county attorneys, the Yuma County Attorney's Office in southern Arizona, it's a border county, did a fiscal analysis of what this law might mean to be implemented in their county. And what they came up with was tens of millions of dollars that would result from trying to implement this law. And the costs would all be derived from not only having to train law enforcement, but also looking at increased costs for the courts, increased costs for jails and bed space, needing to hire new public defenders, needing to bring on new prosecutors. This is potentially just would be further gutting the non-existent public coffers of Arizona.
And in that interim, until plans are in place and money gotten to implement this, it would seem that more people will then be incarcerated in sort of a holding pattern. Is there the potential that they will then be turned over to ICE?
Absolutely. The successful complete implementation of SB 1070 depends on and hinges on the collaboration of ICE. There's various components of the law that require verification, consulting with ICE to verify somebody's immigration status. There's provisions that lay out how the transfer of somebody who has been detained by local police if they don't have their immigration paper and having them serve out their time in the local jail and then being transferred over to ICE to be put in removal proceedings. So again, we've been calling on the administration to step up, and if indeed they are opposed to this legislation, as we have heard President Obama and Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano say, then they need to follow that through and announce that they will not participate in the implementation of this law.
Does Border Action Network have a proposed either retailoring of this legislation or a model suggested plan that you would present?
There is simply nothing workable in this legislation. And that has been a stance that even local businesses have taken, business owners, faith leaders. This law is essentially a combination of six or seven separate pieces of legislation that the bill's sponsor, Senator Russell Pierce, has been trying to get through the Arizona legislature for the last 4 or 5 years. Most of these, as separate bills, have all been killed in the past, or they had been vetoed by then-Governor Napolitano. They are part of what Senator Pierce describes as a strategy of attrition, targeting immigrant communities, immigrant families in Arizona, which is essentially just to wear people out, to push people farther into the shadows, to push people into so much fear they will eventually make a decision to just leave the state. This legislation that it's not motivated really by public safety or increasing security. It's much more motivated around pushing families out of the state of Arizona and creating such a hostile environment that people simply cannot survive.
That brings me to my next question. I hear that there's a significant white power movement with some Republican ties in your area. Have you had interactions with them?
Senator Russell Pierce, this legislation's proponent, has been a speaker at white supremacist-affiliated and associated organizations. And there we had white nationalist groups show up at the Capitol and rally. There is definitely a strong and growing presence of white nationalist, white supremacist groups within Arizona, and they are bolstered by national organizations.
And they're taking this up as their cause, I imagine.
Absolutely.
Have you worked at all with the Minutemen? Are they still around?
Yes, in fact, the Minutemen are around. This week, interestingly, Senator Pierce has another piece of legislation that is moving through the Arizona legislature, and it actually has to be approved by probably by Thursday when our legislature is set to adjourn. It's called it's a border security. The bill would create a new border security commission. The main component of it would actually allocate $200,000 to create a volunteer border security force. So essentially, it would be a state-sponsored vigilante group. They would get state money to provide them equipment, presumably arms, uniforms. That bill is moving through the legislature quickly, and what Senator Pierce, the proponent of 1070, did is he just recently tacked on a couple of amendments to this border security force bill that are an attempt to appease and fulfill some of his promises to Republicans that were opposed to 1070 but wanted some modifications to it. So Pierce has now tacked those modifications onto this kind of state vigilante bill so that everybody will vote for it. If they want to minimize the impact of 1070, then they have to sign onto a state-sponsored vigilante group.
Who would these individuals be?
We actually have a pending case with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights charging the U.S. government with human rights violations for failing to prosecute vigilante groups on the Arizona border, because we've documented more than 1,000 people who've been detained by civilian groups who have been shot at, kicked, abused, physically, verbally. And we know that there's already issues around a lack of accountability, lack of training, lack of oversight. There's simply no checks and balances and protections when you throw out volunteers onto the border patrolling, literally hunting for human beings. So now Russell Pierce is trying to appease some of the concerns on 1070, but also then exacerbating the problems on the border by throwing more vigilante groups down there.
So essentially the state will be subsidizing, if this passes, increased vigilantism by private individuals who are committing unlawful acts of assault on people trying to cross the border, or is it people living on the border?
They are supposed to be targeting people that are walking across the border through somewhere other than a port of entry. However, the common misconception is that the U.S.-Mexico border on the U.S. side is kind of a barren zone of just desert or river or mountains. But the reality is there's 6 million people that live on the U.S. side of the border alone. So there's schools, there's churches, there's people walking down the sidewalk and going out to dinner. And the vast majority of residents on the U.S. side of the Mexican border are Mexican-American or of Mexican descent. So they fit the profile in many ways of an undocumented immigrant just based on sight. So we've heard reports in previous years when Minutemen have organized these big patrols down in the border area in Arizona of just residents being stopped by Minutemen and being asked to prove their legal status in the country and being accused of being undocumented immigrants.
It's not hard to imagine from there Minutemen and other vigilante groups actually going to the doors of houses and knocking on them and asking for identification.
It is possible. We have not documented such incidents, but it's all in the realm of possibility.
And the lawsuit that you mentioned, that was filed by Border Action Network, were any other groups involved?
We're the plaintiffs, and it's filed with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of the Organization of American States.
And what stage is that lawsuit in?
The case has recently been accepted by the commission and will hopefully be proceeding to a hearing on the merits of the case later this year.
Jennifer, can you just tell us a little bit more about what Border Action Network does?
Sure. We are a human rights community organization. We're a membership-driven group. Our members are immigrant men, women, and youth that live throughout the state of Arizona and families that call the Arizona-Mexico border region home. People become a member of Border Action Network because, one, they want to know what their rights are in the United States, in Arizona. We then train people as well in how government works, how policies are made. And then we work to bring people together in their communities and around the state to be able to affect those policies, to change the policies. So we do a lot of work just at a local level, pushing for greater accountability, responsibility from local officials. We work at a state level, particularly focused on our state legislature and trying to push back on the growth of these anti-immigrant measures and promoting good state policies like integration and civic participation. And then we do a lot of work nationally on pushing for immigration reform, but also around border policy and trying to ensure that border security incorporates protections of human rights, oversight, it's cost-effective, and supports and values the roles of local communities and local economies on the border.
I know that 2 years ago, the Washington-based Pew Hispanic Center issued a report, and I'm not sure if Border Action Network was part of that, but it said that one in every 10 Latinos reported having been stopped by police and asked about their immigration status. Were you involved in that?
We were not involved in producing it, but the results of the report are consistent with what the reality is on the ground in Arizona.
And I would imagine if the Pew Center were to redo this report in a year or so, we're going to see quite an increase in that number, unfortunately.
We would expect so, considering that at least here in the state of Arizona, it would be almost, police would be required to stop people essentially based on their profile.
And one of the byproducts of this is going to be the destruction of families. If, say, a mother or father is stopped, incarcerated, we're going to see, or even if both parents were, what's going to happen to the young children?
And that is one of the points that we have been trying to make both to the legislature before this bill was passed and to the governor. I think there's an image in people's minds, particularly along in the border region, that immigrants, undocumented immigrants, people just have an image of a single man in his 20s who is here working and all of his family is back in Mexico or El Salvador or wherever. The reality now is that our families are all so mixed that there might be somebody who is living here and that has an expired tourist visa, and someone else in the household is a U.S. citizen. Somebody might be a permanent resident. The reality is that this bill, SB 1070, is so broad. Not only does it threaten to rip apart the fabric of immigrant families, but it threatens to rip apart the families of everyone in the state of Arizona. It's that is what the face and the reality of immigration is now, is that our status is all so mixed and citizenship is such a long process that we are all tremendously affected by this legislation.
Do you think that this is a broad attempt to affect voting demographics?
I think it's a broad effect to alienate and marginalize certain sectors of our community. We are, as a result of 1070 being passed, working with other organizations across the state to launch one of the most coordinated and what we hope will be one of the most effective voter mobilization strategies. Because clearly, members of our legislature and our governor in particular, they heard a preponderance of concerns from people from all over the state. In fact, Governor Brewer was delivered more than 80,000 signatures, majority of whom were all Arizonans, opposed to this legislation. She received tens of thousands of phone calls every day, and emails, I should say, every day urging her veto of this legislation. Clearly, they're not paying any attention or taking into consideration what constituents want, what the voters of Arizona want, what the residents want. So we'll be working with others from around the state to make sure that at least the Latino community that's eligible to vote is registered to vote, informed about what's happening in the elections this year, and that gets out to vote so that elected officials like Governor Brewer cannot just write off the Latino community like we have had happen with 1070.
I would imagine that with the law enforcement community opposed to this legislation, that you might have a strong ally there. Do you think it's conceivable that any police unions would file lawsuits protesting the fact that this is mandatory for them?
Well, there was actually just a statement made on a Arizona news station that the sheriff of Pima County, it's a border county, and includes Tucson, Arizona, that the sheriff announced that he's not going to participate in SB 1070. That it's a horrendous legislation and that it would be disastrous for him to try to enforce.
That reminds me, after 2001, we had legislation around the country requiring certain police units to report information, and some refused to. So perhaps we will see a courageous response from certain law enforcement officials on this matter.
And I think we will. There was a national press conference with law enforcement, chiefs of police and other law enforcement leadership, in which they came out boldly, clearly condemning SB 1070 and saying that it's simply not useful for police and, in fact, makes their work more difficult and will make communities and public safety decline.
Jennifer, it's just been a pleasure to have you on. You've shared so much information with us. We wish you the best of luck. What is the website for Border Action Network?
We can be reached, and we'll keep our website updated with additional information as the days progress, and that's borderaction.org. Border Action is all one word.
Borderaction.org. I looked at it. It has a wealth of information, and thank you so much for your hard work on this.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
We are thrilled to welcome back Sarah Kunstler, daughter of the late radical civil rights lawyer William Kunstler and the co-director of the documentary about her father, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. That fabulous, amazing movie is now available on a DVD with remarkable bonus sections. Included are pieces on Wounded Knee, speeches Bill gave after the Chicago trial, actual excerpts from the audio of the Chicago trial, and many other important talks, not just relevant for when they were given in the 70s and the 80s, but expressions of the kinds of political action we need today. The movie has been described as a sensitive, truthful, and insightful film. He became the center of a confrontational movement and the public spokesperson for countless of communities standing up to injustice. The story of this radical attorney is told by his daughters in an intimate narrative from the Chicago Seven to the Attica trials, the American Indian movements to the occupation of Wounded Knee.
Welcome again, Sarah, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, we're all excited to hear about the progress of the film since you were last on, reaction from people. How's it doing?
It's been great. We had a theatrical run, I think, in about 25 cities. And Emily and I went to as many of them as we could. We couldn't go everywhere, but we were in Chicago. We were in San Francisco, L.A. Emily went to a lot more than I did because she does not have a year-old son to take care of. But it has been uniformly terrific. Before we were in theaters, we saw it with film festival audiences, and those audiences are great, but there's nothing like sitting there and seeing it with an audience of regular people.
And I remember in our last interview, you mentioned initially being in those audiences and what it felt like to hear the reaction. Is it still as exciting to be amidst first-time viewers?
Emily and I pretty much hold our breath, our collective breath, for the first 10 minutes of the film every time we watch it. We look for reactions. You know, we get anxious if people aren't reacting the way we think they should be, if they're not laughing or responding. I mean, it's like being on stage every single time.
We're talking to Sarah Kunstler, one of the co-directors with her sister Emily, of the film about their dad, Bill Kunstler, called Disturbing the Universe, which is now out on DVD.
What we loved about the DVD release is the bonuses with it and the several interviews of your father at different significant points in his life, at the Chicago 7 trial and after Wounded Knee. It's quite an educational piece altogether. I was thinking that if someone were teaching a class in civil liberties, this would be just a fabulous component to have.
I want to go to those bonuses, but it's coming out soon. People will be able to see it on POV, Point of View on TV.
Yeah, it's going to be on POV, the documentary series on PBS, on June 22nd.
Yeah, but if you want to see it before that, if you want it in your permanent library, which I would suggest you should want, you can get it on Amazon or Netflix. What is your website, Sarah?
Our website is disturbingtheuniverse.com. The PBS, if you watch it on PBS, it's great, but you also don't get the special features.
The special features, that's what Heidi was talking about, are quite remarkable. And I know there's some you really liked, Heidi, so why don't you talk to Sarah about those?
Well, I loved the Chicago 7 case because listening to that judge who was almost a character out of Saturday Night Live, his voice.
I always forget his name. I always call him Judge Magoo.
That's what Bill called him.
Magoo. But what was his name? Hoffman, right?
Julius Hoffman.
Tales of Hoffman, right?
But the exchange is so fabulous to listen to your father really standing up for what was right, but having no fear whatsoever of being held in contempt. And so that and the part where there's some audio actually of when Bobby Seale was bound and gagged in the courtroom was very moving to me. I felt like I was there.
Those are separate pieces of audio that I know aren't in the film. But the film itself, I should say, both the film is incredible, and you cry every time you see it. And, of course, it concerns some of the major struggles in America from the 60s on, and it's fabulous. These bonus pieces are amazing. So why don't you talk about when did you first hear the Chicago pieces?
The Chicago pieces, I think we got them from the Center for Constitutional Rights Archive, and they were on reel-to-reel tape.
Oh, my gosh.
So and I think it was the original tape that the court reporter recorded it on. And we had to take that tape and get it transferred, and we had no idea which pieces of the courtroom were going to be there or which pieces of audio. And it was fantastic. You know, we'd read the transcripts, we'd heard stories, but getting to listen to that audio was getting to be there in the courtroom.
So give us some description. It's one of the issues that at least is on the DVD or that you heard on the tape of your dad is taking them on, taking the judge on Seal or on what, when he's on the piece you put on?
One of the pieces, you know, he takes him on about the binding and gagging of Bobby Seal. I mean, what you hear there is you hear somebody who's absolutely unafraid of being held in contempt. This is a person who is outraged by the treatment of his clients and who is going to stand up. And it's, I'm a lawyer. We're all lawyers here. It takes, you know, I don't know that I have that kind of courage to do that, to stand up like that. It's, a courtroom is an intimidating place. It's meant to be an intimidating place. It's meant to make you feel like you kind of have to back down and be respectful. And sometimes that can blind you from doing what's right. And it seems from those tapes that he didn't let the austere surroundings get to him.
It's a very good point. I mean, when I hear you described in the courtroom by your co-counsel, they always think you have a lot of your father in you in terms of your courage in the courtroom, even though you've only been practicing for a few years. But it was said about Bill that no one of his generation could dominate a courtroom like your dad could. I mean, Bill was remarkable. I mean, I don't care who the judge was, whoever it was, he just was, as you said, he was fearless in a courtroom. Just
well, and he
fearless.
Was he was tall and handsome and poised and well-educated and had the most beautiful voice.
Just like
the voice of an actor. and counterpose him to that little bald Magoo.
What?
You know, that contemptible
little
guy.
Talk about
guy.
People's hair here.
It was, well, Bill has a whole, I'm not going to steal any of his lines, but he had a whole comedy routine about the Judge Magoo, which is partly in the movie and I think probably in the outtakes. But like you say, Michael, there was nobody as courageous as Bill. And Michael, you got to write part of the brief, didn't you, when he was held in contempt all those times and faced long prison terms?
Well, I started at the center in 71, and I think at that point they were just beginning to deal with the contempts, two series of contempts. Well, there were two series of contempts on the appeals. There was the appeals on the convictions for interstate riot, which was what they convicted four or five of the Chicago Seven on. And then there was a series of contempts that Bill was supposed to go to jail for over 4 years. And Morty Stavis was the main lawyer who wrote the appeals briefs. But we still have it in the country. I don't know whether it's in your bookshelf or mine, Sarah, but it's a big, thick book called Chicago on Appeal, which has all the briefs. And eventually, Bill beat every one of the contempts. I mean, they got him on one. Judge Janoux, they appointed some special judge from Maine who wouldn't be, you know, crazy, apparently, because every judge was ready to kill Bill for, like, holding the federal court in such contempt. And they did convict him on one, but it didn't mean anything. He never went to jail or anything for it. So it was extraordinary. So the Chicago piece is one extraordinary outtake, or whichever you call them, bonus on this DVD.
We're speaking with Sarah Kunstler, one of the two movie makers, along with her sister Emily, of Disturbing the Universe, which is now out on DVD, finally. Sarah, what's your website again?
Our website is disturbingtheuniverse.com, and you are welcome to order it directly from the filmmakers.
Sarah, another moving part of the film was, of course, the Recollections of Attica. And I know that moved your father tremendously. I wanted to ask you what it was like to interview the guard, where you showed him as a young man, and then you interviewed him in present day. Found that a special part.
What was his name again?
Michael Smith, actually. Right. And another Michael Smith.
Right. Yeah, and the other famous Michael Smith, of course, is the jockey, who I bet on four times in a row at Saratoga and lost.
Well, this
all four.
Michael Smith, the guard, actually was filled with bullets after the assault on the prison.
Right.
So, Sarah, he was first. I mean, he was a guard.
He was a young guard. You know, he was an idealist. He was a humanitarian. He was a real human being. He's one of those people that meeting him and learning his story makes you realize how often we prejudge people because of the way they look or the jobs they have. And you know, I look at corrections officers all the time, and I would never assume that there's a Michael Smith behind the facade, and I should. And, you know, he was absolutely devastated, as many people there were, by what happened at Attica. But he did not, unlike many, blame the prisoners for what happened. He rightly put the blame for the massacre on the state. And, you know, he was just an incredible person to have the opportunity to meet with and hear his story.
Now, I'm not sure we're going to have a chance to find it. I may have it somewhere, but you guys once gave it to me when you were smaller. I reminded you of the Judy Collins song, about a prison guard at Attica. If you remember it, she wrote an amazingly political song. It was the prison guards who were hostages during the Attica Rebellion in 1971, and they were singing the song from their point of view about how, don't worry about a thing, you know, we're hostages, they're going to come and they're going to save us, they're going to negotiate. And then when the bullets start firing, the sort of punchline is that, and it is, we're just as worthless to them as the prisoners are. And but if they had Nelson Rockefeller in here, who had, of course, refused to visit with the prisoners and try and negotiate an end, they would have opened every prison in the world to free Nelson Rockefeller. So this amazing song about solidarity, really, with the guards and the prisoners, in terms of at least particularly the perceptions of the powers. It's quite a wonderful piece of music she wrote.
It's interesting, in one of the outtakes, an interviewer asked your father who some of his favorite witnesses had been in the Chicago 7 case, and he mentioned Allen Ginsberg and Judy Collins. I hadn't known she testified.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that. Huh?
I've seen the movie 3 times now, and I like it better every time I see it, and I can't wait to get the DVD to get even more of it. And I think, for me, what made the movie so extra special was not only getting to relive my relationship with Bill, who I met when I was in law school at Wisconsin back in 1965, but to also learn about your growing understanding of your father. And I think it was that aspect of the movie that made it so extra special. Now that you've had a chance to share that with other people, what are your reflections on that?
It's strange because when you make a film or when you put together any kind of creative work, the film is kind of arrested in time. And what I've learned, I guess, is that my relationship with my father continues, that it certainly continued after his death, and it continues beyond the film. And it's a relationship that I think I'll have my entire life as I grow older. I continue to see him differently. I continue to see our relationship differently. And I continue to engage with him in how he would want me to live my life. And, you know, whether I'm debating with that idea or agreeing with it, it's a lifelong thing. So I think that when Emily and I started out making this film, we thought it was something that we were going to be getting over, that making this film was kind of closing a chapter, closing a book. And in a way it was. But at the same time, you know, that in life after the film, I've realized that it's going to go on.
A beautiful way to say it, Sarah. I appreciate that.
We go now to hear an excerpt from William Kunstler during the trial of the Chicago 7.
Could you go into, Bill, some of the examples of the kind of conduct that the judge has cited thus far on the record as contumacious?
Well, he has taken every sharp exchange as contumacious. For example, at one time, the judge said, in answer to a question of mine, that why we had to come a half hour earlier on a Saturday when we were working one day later a week, that the answer was because. And I retorted that that was what a child answers when he's asked a difficult question. And then he intoned, let the record show that in the presence of the jury, the defense counsel called the trial judge a baby. That kind of thing is what's in the record. There have been many sharp exchanges, most of them having to do with unfair treatment by the judge, as alleged by the defendants and their counsel. And he has said on many occasions that we would have to answer for that later. That was contumacious conduct, and we would have in the future to answer for it in his court or some other court. I think in the main, I don't think if I went back over the trial, I would do any differently. These were hot exchanges in a heartfelt case where the stakes are high, not for the defendant so much in jail time, though that's high enough, but for the country as a whole. And I thought under those circumstances, I had to be more aggressive in the courtroom than I had ever been in my life.
You wrote the film. Did you write it in pieces? Did you edit it as you were going along?
Well, I am the writer of the film, but a documentary film is written in it's written by two people. It's written by the editor and it's written by the writer. So in a way, I think it's more fair to say that Emily and I co-wrote the film because she was the person who was making those editorial choices and my words were fitting around those choices. So yeah, I mean, I don't know any way to describe it other than it felt kind of like it must feel to write an opera, you know, to have a partnership with somebody who's synchronous with you and putting another piece of it together and you're kind of making the whole thing sing together. You know, it was definitely written in pieces. It was a struggle because I didn't know how to write around what we were putting together, or you know, Emily and I would fight about how to say something or whether to include something, but that's what the collaborative process is like.
I want to go back to some of the bonus pieces you get when you get this DVD. You not only get a remarkable film, that it's not like a regular film. You don't just watch it once, you watch it many times because each of the really political and social struggles document are so moving and so important. But one of the bonus pieces that I listened to the other day was on Wounded Knee. I think there's two altogether on Wounded Knee. And one's 1 minute long of your dad talking from the actual occupied Wounded Knee at a time when you listen to it, that it sounds like they're going to be saved, that there's not going to be any shooting or anything. Can you talk about where'd you find that piece? What was the impression when you heard it? It's your dad actually in the Wounded Knee encampment.
Yeah. You know, Emily and I loved finding moments like that because those felt like really kind of cinematic, vivid moments of these of our dad in these places where he's making decisions. And it wasn't, you know, it's so different from your experience of your dad as this kind of older man who's recollecting everything to you. Here he was in the moment at Wounded Knee. And, you know, those audio pieces and a number of the audio pieces on the DVD are from the Pacifica Archive. And we were lucky enough to work in partnership to be able to get that material. And there was so much of it that we couldn't include in the film that we were fortunate to be able to put it on the DVD.
So, Sarah, there's the excerpts on Wounded Knee as a bonus, and there's also two long speeches by her dad. And, of course, he was one of the most mesmerizing speakers you could listen to. There's one he gives in 1970 right after the Chicago verdicts come down. And, as I said, people were convicted in Chicago. And he goes out to, where is it, Santa Barbara?
Yeah, UC Santa Barbara.
UC Santa Barbara. And, of course, at that time, he didn't know that they were going to burn down a bank after his speech. But they tried to first stop him from going to UC Santa Barbara, which you do bring out in the film. And they shows the headlines of Kunstler not to speak or something like that at Santa Barbara. And then the speech is about Santa Barbara. What's the content of the speech that people will really hear? What's the politics of it?
You know, it's interesting because it was at a time in his life where it seems like he was painfully aware that he was being followed from state to state and that the FBI was listening to his speeches and trying to indict him for the same charges the Chicago defendants had been indicted for, crossing state lines to incite a riot. And he was very aware of this image that people carried of him as this person who was capable of doing that, this person whose words could incite action. And so when he speaks there, you know, he is telling the students about that moment of choice, about deciding whether to take action and how if they don't listen to you, you need to take it to the streets. You need to take it where they can hear it. He makes a distinction between picayune violence and real resistance. And it's so strange that he had, to me now, not having lived through it, that he had that kind of awareness of what was going on, of how he was seen and portrayed. And he gave this speech, and afterwards, the students took to the streets and ended up burning down the Bank of America in Isla Vista, the UC Santa Barbara neighborhood. And, you know, I was never charged with it. He always said that he caused it.
He did?
He loved it. But, you know, I don't think that he did. I think that would be unfair to the real activism that was alive on campuses at that time. And it would... You know, to say that he was the person who came in and lit this match, you know, the match was already lit and it was lit on campuses across the country.
You mentioned that he talks about in the speech between picayune violence and real resistance. Talk for a second about what he meant by that. And
I think he was sensitive to the fact that the powers that be, the government, would marginalize resistance when it was perceived as random acts of violence, when it was people using breaking windows that or taking action in that way, that it would be perceived as something thoughtless. And he really wanted to make sure that when young people stood up and took their message to the streets, that people were going to hear them and they weren't just going to see these acts. So when he was making that distinction, that's what he was trying to say. Don't just break windows, you know, take your message to the street.
So this is the speech he gave in 1970 in Santa Barbara, and after which, of course, as you said, the bank was burnt down. But it's a very important speech. It's some 30 minutes on a bonus of the DVD and is really worth people thinking about as we talk about what kinds of actions compel and move governments to take anything positive.
Sarah, what projects, if any, are you working on right now?
Well, right now, Emily is going to Kent State for the 40th anniversary, and she's
40th anniversary of?
The 40th anniversary of the killing of the students there. She's participating in an archiving project. They're beginning to take testimony as part of a truth and reconciliation, to hear the voices of both the guards that came in and participated in the shooting and the students who were engaged in protests on campus. And I guess that's on our immediate horizon.
It was a really important, close part of your father's life was Kent State. He went out every year for the anniversary, as I recall.
Yeah, and it was something that Emily and I really wanted to be able to include in our film, and we weren't able to, one of many things we weren't able to include in the film, because we really, what was important about Kent for our father and what we wanted to share was that he had this close bond with the students there and that it continued, and that it was a relationship that he went back year after year. The Blanket Hill, the hill where the shootings happened, he helped when the students organized to try to prevent any building on that hill, to keep it as a memorial. He went and he supported those demonstrations and those efforts. And he went back year after year to speak at the memorial for the students who died.
We're talking to Sarah Kunstler, who's co-director with Emily Kunstler of the wonderful film about their father, Bill Kunstler, called Disturbing the Universe. It's out on DVD with incredible bonus tracks from Chicago, from Wounded Knee, from speeches Bill gave, really a fabulous political education, not just of the past, but for the future and what action means and how social change comes about. So, Sarah, can you tell us where can people get this DVD again?
People can get the DVD wherever they get DVDs, wherever DVDs are sold. That you can buy it from us at disturbingtheuniverse.com or get it. It's out there. It's in the world.
Thank you so much for coming on again.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later gotta cut you down, sooner or later gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.